The start of the week and loads on the radio. How confidence works, who is caring for the carers after COVID, and Bob Dylan is 80. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Looking at Pfizer and AstraZeneca, Public Health England saying that after the first dose of both, 33% effective against the Indian variant. So you can see how we could land ourselves in big trouble here if we're not careful.
Absolutely. Yeah. We have to be careful as we proceed here.
The great thing about confidence is it's like a fuel additive. It accelerates its effects because a little bit of extra confidence makes you do a little bit more.
If we're heroes, it stops us from being human. And we're human, you know. We're people.
Now, how does it feel to be 80? Bob Dylan's birthday was marked on Radio 1 by many. Let's start with Christy Moore on the Ray Darcy Show.
Good to see you.
Great to be here.
It's very exciting because you're here, which means that we're returning to normality inch by inch. You're vaccinated on the double.
Yeah. I have the two jobs, yeah.
How does that feel?
Oh, grand. Well, it feels great. I'm very grateful to have received them, you know. Yeah. And it was a great experience in a way to watch the whole system at work and to watch the people in the medical centre how caring they were and looking after people. And it was quite an experience.
And how were you relieved, joyous, you know, because was there any sort of fear that you'd get COVID during lockdown, during the last year or so?
Definitely in the early days, yeah. Like I think in the first couple of months, nobody knew what was happening, what was going down. Is this it? Is this the end? You know, we were all. And so I went through the same thing as everybody else, but certainly very grateful when the vaccine came along, you know, and maybe there's some chance that we might be able to get out and do a bit of work again.
I don't know what the law is now because I've been vaccinated once and you've been vaccinated twice. So I don't know if we can half hug, if we have to elbow, if we have to be 2 metres apart or 1 metre apart. Anyway, just to be safe, we're about 2 metres apart.
But we can't kiss on the lips.
We can't kiss on the lips. And I put my lipstick on and all after. There you go. Otherwise. So that's exciting that you're here. That's just, imagine that. Just saying that you're here is very exciting. And the reason you're here is because you called us last week and you said that you'd written a song to celebrate Bob Dylan's 80th birthday, which is today.
Yeah.
So he was born 1941, May 24th, Robert Allen Zimmerman. So we'll talk a little bit about Dylan. You might sing us the song. We'll play some Dylan music and then we might chat about Christy and what's going on in your world. And I know you're recording an album, which is very exciting because it's the first studio album in how long?
Since 2016.
Is it right? 5 years, yeah. You've done a good bit since then.
I've been a few live collections and a few bits on the road.
Right.
You know.
And you're buzzed up and excited about being back in the studio.
Ah, yeah, it's great. It's great to meet up with the crew and to be doing a bit of work, even though it's... Today, to me, is I'm out and I'm doing something. It's great, you know.
I was just doing a bit of research there. So the first time you sang on RT Radio 1 was in 1968.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be 53 years ago.
In Henry Street.
Can you remember the song you sang?
I have a feeling it was Bogey's Bonnie Bell and the Dalesman's Litany.
That's, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I remember it well. Yeah, it was Liam Nolan in Henry Street. And I remember the studio and it was very exciting. I actually came home from England to do it. And I remember my mother being so excited about it. In actual fact, when that happened, I think it was the first time that my mother got a bit of hope that her son was on radio wearing, having given up the precious bank job in 1966. She was, I suppose, 3 years later, she heard me on the wireless and...
What age were you? Early 20s?
Would have been 23 then.
23, yeah. Yeah. So that was a big moment for you.
On the wireless.
Now, those 58 years later, here you are.
I remember the first television thing as well,
what
too.
What was that?
It was with Mike Murphy. A thing called... it was a programme that was made simultaneously in Dublin and in Edinburgh. And Mike Murphy was the host. Oh, no, that wasn't the first one. No, the first one, Ronnie Drew was on it.
Right.
I sang the Ballad of James Larkin and Avondale. And the sweat was pouring out of me. The porter was bulging out of me.
So loads of things to talk about. You never met Dylan, did you?
No. But I met a fellow who knows him very well.
Liam Clancy, is it?
No, Liam, God. I met Liam. And I was thinking maybe the one thing that myself and Bob Dylan have in common is that we were both very influenced by Liam Clancy.
Yeah.
You know, he was...
The difference being that he met him in New York and you encountered him in Buncloddy.
In Buncloddy, for 30, yeah. Flakjol in Buncloddy. Yeah. He was standing on the street on a Sunday afternoon with his guitar singing, and I was just enthralled by it.
To the point where you said, this is for me, sort of thing.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. He lit a candle that day that's still burning.
Yeah. And he lit a candle for Dylan as well, didn't he? Well, the Clancy brothers, when he encountered them in the East Village in New York.
Yeah, Dylan was very affected by Liam Clancy and by his singing, and at one stage has said that Liam may have been the best folk singer he ever heard.
Has he heard you?
I doubt it.
Yeah. So you never met him, but you did mention him in a song. Me and BB is the song. And the line is, then Bob Dylan came and ruined the bloody lot of it. So how did he do that? That's your words from Me and BB. You mentioned Bob Dylan.
God, I'd forgotten all about that. Yeah. But I mentioned him in another thing as well. I never met Bob Dylan, but I sang with Pecker Dunn. And when we drank Loch Éireann dry, we went looking for Loch Dan. The crack was good in Cricklewood, but was better in it by when Maggie Barry called me up to sing The Wild Colonial Boy.
Brilliant. And Ray wondered about Bob's reaction to his 80th birthday being celebrated all over the world.
Not that you can speak for the man himself, but do you think Bob Dylan has a wry smile on his face today as everybody intellectualises and analyses his cultural clout?
I haven't got the faintest idea. You know, the man is a pure
enigma,
a poet, a genius. He's everything. He's everything rolled up into one. I suppose it must be hard going, you know. I mean, to all over the world have people talking about something that, I don't know. He's...
Because you, like, I read in the book there, you were talking about doing interviews and, you know, and you're, the last three words are, sing the song. And I can hear you saying that, just sing the song, you know. Because that's ultimately what it's about, isn't it? Singing the song.
I love his gigs, though. I mean, for the last 10 or 15 years, I've actually taken to bringing a little pair of binoculars in and just watching him. He's intriguing to watch.
Go on.
Well, just what he goes on with, you know, and the way he shuffles and the way he moves and the way he, you know, he's been doing it longer than I have.
Mm.
And, you know, the amount of gigs he's gotten through, and he's obviously addicted to performing because he doesn't need the gig. But
somebody who hasn't been to a gig, just talk us through, if you would, just a Bob Dylan gig.
Well, there's such an air of expectation, you know, and the cross, across the years, there are all kind of ages there at Dylan gigs, you know, different generations coming together. And it's about the songs, you know, and to hear young people who weren't born when the songs were recorded singing them with gusto, you know.
Yeah.
There's just a great atmosphere about the gigs. And I've seen them in all kinds of different places, and I've seen a couple of gigs that were quite dark. But latterly, I just like to sit there and drink it all in, yeah. You know.
Christy Moore from The Ray D'Arcy Show, and earlier on Today with Claire Byrne.
So having recorded more than 600 songs and released 39 studio albums, Bob Dylan turns 80 today. The man often regarded as one of the greatest songwriters of all time began his career 60 years ago and has embraced just about every form of popular music. And with me in studio to celebrate his life and work is Coitra Reardon, musician and former bass player with the Pogues, who was dancing along to that, and Brian Lally, presenter of Country Time on RTÉ Radio 1. You're both very welcome.
Hello.
It changes something when you hear the music, doesn't it? Changes
really
the
does.
Vibe of the morning.
Salute him when his birthday comes, as he said himself in one of his songs. And it's great to be here on the 80th. Marvellous.
Well, can we talk first of all about the effect that Bob Dylan has had on people's lives? I was reading excerpts of Sinead O'Connor's book at the weekend and she was talking about him. Her brother Joe was writing about him. Just profound impacts on people as they grew up, Coich.
Yeah, well, retrospectively for me, the actual week that I was born, Bob went in the studio and recorded Bringing It All Back Home, which is when he went half electric, half acoustic, dipped his toe in the water, early clue to the new direction. 1965, he goes electric and creates The World I Live In. So even I grew up being a bit disrespectful about Bob because he wasn't the culture for me. You know, it was the Bay City Rollers and the Wombles, to be honest. But when people who are a bit older than me, when I started gigging with people and working with people, at some point somebody gave me Bringing It All Back Home and said, this was made the week you were born. And that's an immense album. And then you start learning about Newport when he went up there and played electric and caused absolute uproar. And then you started, this guy is punk. Forget Johnny Rotten.
Yeah.
How ballsy was that? How immense. I think Bob's wired differently. I think his nervous system is very different. And that's why we need him.
Brian?
And critically, Bring It All Back Home, Blonde on Blonde, and Highway 61 were recorded in the space of about 15 months. Three of the extraordinary albums of all of rock and roll music and not a folk song on them, which is another side of Bob Dylan because he keeps getting referred to as a folk singer. He was a folk singer for three albums. And then another side of Bob Dylan came along and that was when he kicked open the door of songwriting because he just threw away the rule book.
Did you always appreciate him, Brian, or were you similar to Coich in that you learned as you matured how special he was and his work?
Well, sadly, I'm old enough to have been in little school choirs and ballet groups and things like that, and we all sang Blown in the Wind, and I actually thought it was a traditional song. I actually thought because it had been handed down.
Yes.
And I would have heard Peter, Paul and Mary singing it before I heard Bob Dylan singing it. But, I mean, I came to him in about 1976 or 7. And a friend of mine had an album called Hard Rain, which is a live album, a very difficult live Bob Dylan album, which is really, it's very raw and it's very painful. And there's divorce songs on it and there's separation songs on it. There's revisitings of Maggie's Farm, but it's totally different from the Maggie's Farm that we all know. So it was quite a difficult album to get into. But that was the gateway. That was the gateway drug for me. And then it was into Street Legal and then it was into Budokan and then there was no going back.
Is there any other artist, though, that people can spend hours talking about him, dissecting his lyrics, talking about how he lives, you know, how he promotes himself, which is not very much at all because he doesn't need to. But the conversations can go on and on and on about Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I at some point I was working with someone, they started referring to Bob as a member of the Awkward Squad. And I'm like, who's the Awkward Squad? They said, it's Bob Dylan, it's Neil Young, it's Tom Waits, it's Lou Reed. And I just thought, Bob's the only one out of the Awkward Squad that I'm not really into as an artist. I'm more into him as this my weird Uncle Bob who does eccentric things. You know, someone will come in the studio and say, have you heard what Bob's done now? And they're not talking about a record. Yeah. You say, what's he done now? He's joined the Grateful Dead. Or you'll go, oh,
yeah,
classic
he
Bob.
Did that. But even as a very early developing artist, he was in the Awkward Squad. I mean, imagine this. At the age of maybe 22... he's invited on to the Ed Sullivan Show, which is the biggest program in American television. Now, he wants to do a thing called Talking John Birch Society Blues, which is a very anti-communist song.
Paranoia blues.
And he wants to do that. The record company and the TV company don't let him do that. And he says, sodgy, all I'm off. Yeah. I'm not going to do the Ed Sullivan Show. And he did that like loads of times. In 1983, he had a fantastic appearance on the David Letterman Show, promoting ostensibly Infidels. And David Letterman holds up the album. This is his new work and it's a fine piece of work. It's called Infidels. So Bob is over there with a pickup band of punks and they tear into a Sonny Boy Williamson blues tune, which is not obviously an Infidels.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just does a revisiting of Joker Man, which is, and License to Kill, which is. And it's one of the greatest TV Bobs of all time. But who else but Bob Dylan would do that?
Would do that.
Brian Lally and Coich Reardon on Today with Claire Byrne.
And on the live line. I don't even like to think about this time last year. We were going through the end of the first wave and it was a terrible time for so many people. But this call to Joe just gives an insight into how nursing staff are feeling after the trauma of COVID-19 outbreaks in nursing homes. Sarah spoke to Joe in the afternoon.
The problem that I have is that I'm a nursing manager in a nursing home providing care for 100 residents. And okay. I love that place. I loved the director of nursing and her management team.
Yeah.
Loved the people living and working there and felt appreciated and respected for the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And we worked well together. But by the end of January of 2020, which is last year,
yeah.
realization had dawned on me when I was reading about Wuhan
yeah.
that we were in serious trouble. And I'm sure you know by now, Joe, listening to other people, that our residents become second family to us.
Yeah.
So I can only speak personally, really, that 2020, it was a terrible year.
Yeah.
It was just stolen by COVID. The worry, the terror, the loneliness that I experienced was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I was focused on protecting our residents. So I woke up to COVID every morning and it was my last worry at night. And my days off were spent studying, attending Zoom conferences,
mm-hmm.
trying to catch up with the overwhelming stream of information. But in reality, I was drowning. Like a lot of my colleagues,
mm-hmm.
I chose to live a life apart and to live alone from March 2020 for the sake of our residents and my family.
Gosh.
My partner was banished, bless him. He ran my errands. He did my grocery shopping and dropped them into the boot of my car in a car park while we exchanged poignant virtual hugs. My fractured relationships with family and friends were all conducted through WhatsApp and Zoom. It was desperately lonely, but it was a kind of shared loneliness because many of my colleagues also had made this choice and all of our residents were suffering this separation from their family and friends.
Yeah.
Mainly because we were afraid that we could transmit what was an invisible killer unknowingly. And the work seemed worth it to all of us because we succeeded in keeping COVID out of the nursing home.
Well done.
That was until January 2021. Okay. Our first positive resident was detected just before our vaccination program began in January 2021. This has mirrored all across the country. Within days, two-thirds of our residents had tested positive and half of our staff were out due to COVID. No description is adequate. Nothing can describe the horror that engulfed us. There's no emergency plan could prepare anyone for the speed and the impact of this catastrophic event. It was shock after shock. It was decision after decision. Heartbroken telephone call after telephone call. Zoom call after Zoom call. Death after death. It was so fast and so cruel. But you prioritised. I remember saying to myself, just keep breathing, just keep moving, just keep going. We'll get through it. We'll get through this eventually. So I contracted COVID in January.
Nice.
I think it was mainly due to the effect of a long, exhausting year
mm-hmm.
and to working in the thick of it. I was very sick, but in a sense, it was a relief to let go, to just be sick. I was alone, but I had support from my friends and my partner. I went back to work very quickly, but soon realised that I was too unwell to work and came out again. Mm. On my return the next time, I found myself to be not just breathless, but just very traumatised. I experienced terrors and flashbacks, death, insomnia. Mm. I was all over the place emotionally, and there was a strange kind of memory loss. Like I'd write constant lists, and I'd remember, but I'd be remembering forgotten tasks from my day, usually at about 2 a.m. So I'm on sick leave and I'm not fit to work at present. I try to imagine going back to work, but at the moment, Joe, the thought fills me with dread.
Mm-hmm.
I remain breathless and exertion. I'm attending counselling and I'm working with the trauma and I do expect to improve in time.
And do you get any sick pay or?
So the problem was because I returned to work after contracting COVID initially. I'm on sick leave. It's not COVID leave from work.
Uh-huh.
So I'm in receipt of illness benefit, which is €203 a week. It's not COVID payments, there were 350 social welfare. And then again, this will be mirrored in nursing homes across the country. My employer's policy regarding COVID leave allowed for, where it was COVID leave, it allowed for full pay, but their sick leave policy is different from the HSE policy even. So as a result, I'm due to go on half pay, and after 4 weeks, I'll receive no pay. And I'm paying my medical bills and for counselling now. So the GP care is free if somebody has COVID, but not long COVID. So I've already cut back, but within a short while, I'm probably going to give up my car and other bits and pieces. So I suppose the reason why I contacted you was because I know there has to be nurses and medical personnel in Ireland today who are unable to work as a result of COVID. Many of them must be on leave without pay at this time.
Yeah.
And for the, like a lot of our sector has nurses coming in from other countries and they don't even have social welfare. I don't know how they're managing. So like, I feel that I contracted this awful and it's a possibly life-limiting condition because I'm a frontline worker. But it feels like an insult has been added to the injury.
And Sarah spoke about the way the new variant had ripped through the nursing home after Christmas.
Well, statistically, I mean, the percentages are high nationally. I think I think they were saying because it was a British variant, I think they were looking at about 1,000 deaths due to that, you know, in January of this year.
So do you know, is there a campaign that, for example, frontline workers who are ill should be on put on the COVID payment rather than the sick pay, which is much less? Has that been raised, I wonder?
Well, what I was hoping to do, just by the fact of you airing this, maybe to hear what is happening, it's the nature of how we are, particularly when we're ill, that we end up almost very splintered, you know. I suppose it's hard to fight. We tend to fight for other people's rights. Mm-hmm. It's hard for us to fight for our own rights. I mean, we tend, particularly carers, you know, carers very much care for other people, and they're not great at caring for themselves usually.
It's just horrific. And I was reading there over the weekend, for example, in India alone, I know it's a different demographic, but just to give you a picture, and we've lost medics here. In India alone, over 1,000 doctors have died from COVID.
Yeah.
It's just the figures are just breathtaking at this stage.
And you see many of our staff are Malaysian. And even during when the pandemic was very virulent in the UK, they were losing friends and family. But the other problem is, as I said to you, you know, our residents become second family to us. But again, it's the nature of nursing homes, you know. Like people end up having their own parents in nursing homes and having aunts and uncles and family members in nursing homes, especially out the country.
Mm-hmm.
So people lost their own family as well as caring for the other residents. They had their own family members, mothers and fathers or aunts and uncles in that population as well.
And Jo asked Sarah if she would stay in nursing.
I suppose one of the reasons why you stay in nursing particularly is because I often think of Archbishop Desmond Tutu's phrase of being a prisoner of hope. So I'm always hopeful, you know. I as I said to you, it's an uncertain future.
Yeah.
I mean, my focus at the moment is just simply around recovery, and then we'll see. I think one of the things just to add is, like, I'm nursing in Ireland for more than four decades, and as a young nurse, you know, because we were all indoctrinated into the belief that it was a vocation, we really, it was seen almost as being something that you didn't do. You didn't look for having rights, for having a sustainable job that would allow you to rear a family and
not go home utterly drained and exhausted and apologetic. And now we've a new problem, because if we're heroes, it stops us from being human. And we're human, you know? We're people.
That's Sarah on the live line with Joe Duffy. Now on the Ryan Tuberty Show, the reassuring voice of clinical psychologist and neuroscientist Ian Robertson. And Ian was talking about his new book on confidence and the Goldilocks formula of not having too much nor too little.
The great thing about confidence is it's like a fuel additive, that it accelerates its effects, because a little bit of extra confidence makes you do a little bit more. That expands your experiences and your successes, and that multiplies over time, and that happens over a lifetime with people.
Yes.
That's why two kids with exactly the same abilities, one with a tiny bit more confidence at the beginning, that tiny difference exponentially grows and creates a much more yawning gap with time, because confidence creates new opportunities, new experiences, new skills, etc. Whereas if you hold back, you don't get that opportunity.
Does your background, class, race, wealth affect confidence, or are you born with it? I mean,
it's mainly these things.
Is that right? Yeah.
It's mainly, but it's not only that. Bear with me, give 30 seconds
ahead
of the study.
No.
Several thousand twins in the UK, okay? So twins, by definition, each have the same socioeconomic background.
Yeah, sure.
They got them to self-rate their socioeconomic state, their social ladder. Where do you stand on the social ladder? 1 to 10. Most of us can rate ourselves on that. And what they found was that until adolescence, these kids were more or less the same in their self-ratings. But then, for some reason, some of the twins started to rate themselves as lower social status compared to the other twin. Mm. And when they did that, their opportunities declined, their educational attainment declined, their drug use, they were more likely to use drugs, more likely to end up in trouble. So, and we don't understand what happened. Something happened in their adolescence.
Yes.
That they started to perceive themselves to be of lower social status than their twin.
But this is why your book was so interesting. Like,
yeah.
You talk about, at one stage, elite athletes.
Yeah.
Or indeed people who are just high achievers.
Yeah.
And like all great psychology and psychiatry.
Yeah.
You kind of have to go back to their childhood say what has driven them to become something a little more other than everyone else.
That's right. And it seems to be that super elite athletes, I mean,
the Tiger Woods of this world,
it seems to be that super athletes have had a tough experience in their early life. You know, I mean, parents divorce or something like that. And then what they then have is some example. They meet an Olympian. They meet someone who's inspiring in whatever the domain they're wanting to excel in. And then they have some early success experience, maybe an amateur win or something like that.
Yes.
And that kind of seems to create a recipe for really driven people who really go to the top. Now, so Tiger Woods, for example, he had a terrible stutter as a child, and he was really bullied at school. He was really miserable. And then he won the American Amateur Golf Championship at a very young age. And that incredible drive, I mean, no one has won as many, I don't think, or one other golfer has won as many tournaments as he's won. Now, poor guy now, you know, is in a different state. But so that's true not just of Tiger Woods, but in general, you seem to have this adversity.
Yes.
Earlier in your life that then drives you. And that's true of prime ministers of the UK and presidents of the US. Many of them are orphans. Many of them come from single parent families. And it seems to be there's something about early.
Well, Bill Clinton would be a prime example of that.
It
came from a very poor background, but also, again, single mother to an extent.
Exactly. And you know, and Barack Obama had a tough enough, you know, life as well growing up.
Yeah.
So that seems to be that. And, you know, one of the greatest sources of confidence is mastering adversity, is getting through tough times. Because what you do there is you learn that your emotion, you are not your emotions. You learn that anxiety passes. You learn that, yes, you can be low mood, you can be down, but eventually it goes.
Great.
And you learn, and if you can just, if you feel anxious, so I'm thinking of the people who are, you know, maybe anxious about going back, going into college or going back to college, yeah, having never been there. If they can just take the step, just do it in spite of feeling anxious. And this is true of going out socially and things like that.
Yeah.
If you do things in spite of anxiety and you keep doing them, getting through the anxiety, that will build your confidence like few other things.
And stand by for the liberal use of the technical term bullshitty when Ryan asks Ian about overconfidence, especially when there's nothing to back it up.
There is a difference, though, isn't there, between the person who's confident and can back it up with a certain emotional, intellectual ability,
yeah,
versus, excuse the language, but a bullshit artist.
Yes. Yeah.
Who's like this, like, is it Ally McLeod?
Yes.
Right. So describe, compare and contrast those two, those two schools of confidence.
Yeah, Ally McLeod, of course, was he was the Scotland team manager who...
He's panning column B in this example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he, so Scotland had unusually qualified for the World Cup in Argentina. And he created the kind of national delusion, because everyone seemed to buy into it. He created this fantasy bubble. And he was asked, for instance, what are you going to do when Scotland wins the World Cup? As he had said, he says, win it again.
A spoof.
It was the most, and so that kind of bubble, now that was a kind of farcical bubble of overconfidence, but it shows you that confidence is enormously contagious.
Yeah.
And it's contagious because it buys you status, because it lifts people's mood, and that's the source of...
But it's a debased currency, is it not, if it's not delivered upon?
Well, yes, it is.
But like, it's finite then.
But the problem is, it buys you so much in the short and medium term.
Is that enough?
That it can be self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
So Adam Newman, who created the WeWork, for instance, I mean, so based on the most inflated overconfidence, he was going to cure, stop world wars and stop orphans existing in the world. But he ended up with a multi-billion company valuation.
Yeah.
And when it finally, the valuation failed, he went out with a huge packet. And so, I mean, with billions of payoff. And so that's the trouble with overconfidence.
Yeah. You know, in Line of Duty
recently,
as you're talking like that, there was a great discovery of somebody did something bad. I'm worried about giving too much away. But the line that was so good in it was, an example of somebody failing upwards, up the ladder, getting promoted and promoted.
Yeah.
But sometimes they were getting promoted to get them out of the way.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're getting promoted because they were stuck for somebody to put in the job. But either way, they were just eminently unqualified for the job. But this kind of... the confidence of the mediocre middle guy who just drifts up the ladder. You go, that's a strange type of confidence, isn't it?
Well, no, but generally, overconfidence will, in a standard interview panel where your actual abilities are not technically tested, will get you the job more likely than if you're less confident.
That's terribly unfair.
It's unfair, it doesn't make you any better on the job. In fact, as you were saying there, it makes you work.
On the contrary,
the job.
Yeah.
And this penalises women enormously.
Women,
because women on average have less overconfidence than men.
Why?
They're much. So if you give a group of male and female students a geography test, okay, and you get the men say get 7 out of 10, and the women maybe get 7.5 out of 10, and then you say what scores do you think you got on the test? The men will say 8.5 and the women will say 6.5.
And Ryan asked about the gender imbalance with confidence.
Why is there a gender imbalance with regards to confidence? Is that because society has built that up, or is it a more basic?
It's largely society.
It's societal,
built it
okay.
Up.
So that
and,
needs
and
to be...
you know, for instance, women who are bigger and women who feel more physically formidable are more confident than women who are smaller or less. It's as primitive as that.
Yeah.
It started, tens of thousands of years ago, men, when muscles were the main thing.
Big man,
big
confidence.
Man. And so the whole history of beating up women, that kind of physical, basic primitive physical strength has led to women having to adapt to these primitive imbalances and dominance. But we live in a civilization now where these Darwinian principles are no longer relevant.
Yeah.
And actually, we need more women in senior positions because they're less vulnerable to the addictive and distorting effects of overconfidence and power addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, until that is that imbalance is corrected,
yeah.
You know, I don't think the world will be a very safe place.
No, it won't. It won't. It won't.
How are we in terms of confidence of a race? You know, national confidence.
Yes.
So, for example, just as you were talking there, I was thinking, you know, whenever I say to my girls, I say to my daughters, obviously, I'll say, you know, you look beautiful today, and no, I don't. I said, well, hang on a second. We're going to correct this at from the get go. You're an Irish woman. You're going to say, thank you.
Yeah.
You're not going to say, no,
yeah.
I don't.
Right? Yeah.
So do you know what I mean? This is a micro example of what should be a national thing. Because in Ireland, we tend to kowtow a little bit and we kind of bump into somebody. We say, sorry. We don't say, excuse me. You know, it's a strange
thing. It's so interesting you say that, because there actually is an objective measure of bullshitting, which is you in the PISA study of ability across OECD countries.
Mm.
They say, how familiar are you with these mathematical terms from zero, never heard of them, to 10, understand it completely and know it? And they insert five fictitious terms that don't exist in it. And so you get the actual measure of how bullshitty a culture is. And sure enough, which are the most bullshitty countries?
Yeah.
America and Canada. Which are the least bullshitty countries? Well, Scotland's at the very lowest. Ireland's pretty low as well. But you're right. We have this tendency to self-deprecate, to apologise in advance, and seek reassurance. Oh, am I talking rubbish? The trouble with that kind of reassurance seeking and constant self-deprecation, it does actually... the words you say to yourself are important, and it does eat into your confidence.
Yes.
And what's more, it communicates that to the other person. So if you don't appear confident in yourself, why should the other person be confident in you? So we have to be careful we don't fall into the habit of constantly undercutting ourselves, constantly seeking reassurance. You know, this is probably rubbish. Oh, I look terrible today. It's such a mess. So all this kind of stuff.
Just look up a bit more.
Yeah. And the posture is important as well.
Yeah, the shoulders have to be out of it, but without being a strut, of course.
Yeah, without being a strut. I mean, the kind of power pose research hasn't panned out as being validated. But what has panned out is if you constrict your body position.
Yes.
So you know what it's like, you know, students coming into a professor's, they'll tend to make themselves smaller. We tend to make ourselves smaller with more dominant people.
How Confidence Works is the name of the book. That's Ian Robertson from The Ryan Tuberty Show. And in the morning, reaction to the diversion of the Ryan airplane to Minsk. Ordy Carville spoke to Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney.
It was a Ryanair plane en route between two EU capitals when it was intercepted by a Belarusian fighter jet and forced to land in Minsk. On board were 171 passengers and crew. After it landed in the Belarusian capital, authorities arrested 26-year-old Roman Pratosevich, a journalist who played a key role for the opposition in last year's election, which was widely seen as rigged in favour of dictator Alexander Lukashenko. The incident has been strongly condemned by the United States and the European Union, whose leaders will discuss it today. We're joined this morning by the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney. Good morning.
Morning, Audrey.
This incident yesterday has been described as a state-sponsored hijacking and the state-sponsored kidnapping of a journalist. Is that how you would characterise it?
Absolutely. I mean, this was effectively aviation piracy, state-sponsored. It was a an Irish airline, a plane that's registered in Poland, full of EU nationals, travelling between two EU capitals, flying through Belarusian airspace, which would be absolutely normal, particularly flying to Baltic states. It was intercepted. There was effectively a warning given to the pilots and crew to say that there was a security risk on board. And then the plane was escorted by a military jet to Minsk airport, which was not the closest airport. The Ryanair plane was actually much closer to Vilnius in Lithuania, but it was essentially diverted back into Belarus, although it was still in Belarusian airspace. landed in Minsk, and then people came on board and arrested this journalist who was involved in the opposition movement during the presidential election and since in Belarus. And, you know, this can only be described, as I say, as aviation piracy. And I think the EU has to give a very clear response to it. Otherwise, we're giving all the wrong signals. Fortunately, we do have a European Council meeting this evening, so European leaders will have an opportunity to meet and I hope make some pretty clear signals that send a very strong, make some clear decisions that send a very strong signal to a regime in Belarus that has no democratic legitimacy. And is behaving as a dictatorship, repressing their own people, expelling foreign journalists, silencing civil society and human rights defenders. And now we have, you know, an interception of, as I say, an EU plane full of EU citizens in a way that's just completely unacceptable. And, you know, I think if there's indecision or weakness shown by the EU here, it'll reinforce in the minds of the decision makers in Belarus that they've done the right thing here. So okay. I think the response has to be clear, tough, and needs to happen quickly.
Simon Coveney, Minister for Foreign Affairs. Then later, Audrey spoke to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, Belarus's opposition leader.
We are joined now from Lithuania by Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who is the leader of the opposition, and she has been exiled in the country since last year's vote, which was widely seen as being rigged in favour of Alexander Lukashenko. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, what is your reaction to what happened to the Ryanair flight yesterday?
Good morning, everyone. As a matter of fact, we're really shocked with the what has happened, because we see the escalation of the violence from the regime side, and the fact that they forced to land the whole plane. You know, they endangered lives of passengers of 18 nations. 170 passengers were on the board. Just to kidnap one person is a threat not only to Belarusian security, it's threatened to worldwide security at the moment. Of course, we have to raise awareness about the situation in Belarus and try to release all political prisoners.
What do you fear will happen to him in Belarus?
People in Belarus who are jailed, they are tortured harshly, and we really don't know what's going on to him. Lawyer is trying to see Roman Protasevich, but we don't have information about him now. But for sure, he is not in safeness.
Were you on that flight 1 week ago?
Yes, I took the same flight a week ago from Greece. And I, as a matter of fact, I didn't even think that I could get into the same position as Roman. You know, I didn't take care about this. You know,
are you now concerned for your own safety?
You know, I really don't have time to take care of my safety, because people who are in jail in Belarus, they are in a much, much worse position than I am. So we have to take care, first of all, about those people.
What do you think, Svetlana, the European Union, the international community, should do about what happened yesterday?
First of all, we demand immediate international investigation on this case. We are going to raise this issue at the UN Security Council today and tomorrow. I'm already in contact with the ministers of Greece and Ireland. And, of course, we have to ask about immediate release of all political prisoners. And I have to say that the escalation of violence in Belarus is the result of impunity. So we have to put much more pressure on the regime to make them, you know, be more talkative to civil society of Belarus.
Do you think the EU's response to Belarus up until now has been too weak?
You know, we see the escalation of violence, and maybe it was rather slow, I'd say, because since December we haven't had any conferences or round tables on international scene about Belarusian question. And now we urge European unity about imposing the fourth package of sanction list and raise awareness about the situation in Belarus.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya with Audrey Carville from Morning Ireland. Then later, Claire Byrne was talking to Antishuk Michal Martin.
There's been outrage expressed from all quarters about what happened in Belarus yesterday. You've said yourself it was utterly unacceptable. Would you describe, though, what happened to this journalist and activist, Roman Protasevich, as state-sponsored hijacking?
Well, it certainly is a state-sponsored coercive act, and it did forcefully force that plane to land in order to arrest Protasevich, and that is absolutely unacceptable. I think it reflects a growing authoritarianism across the world, but also these authoritarian leaders taking premeditated decisions of this kind, and the European Council will meet later this evening and tomorrow and will have to respond very strongly to it. I'm meeting my Lithuanian counterpart, Gitanis, and Kyriakos, the Greek Prime Minister, later this evening. They sought a meeting with me and in advance. So I think there's going to be a very...
They didn't seek a meeting with you about this subject, did they?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they want to talk to me about this later this evening, obviously from their perspective as two other countries directly involved in this.
Because of Ryanair, is it? Or why did they seek out a meeting with you?
To discuss how we should coordinate a response in the broader EU meeting. And they have very strong views in terms of this. And already there are sanctions against some of the Belarus leaders. The issue will be, will there be a graduated response, stronger response from the EU Council towards the regime, mm-hmm. Both in terms of sanctions and indeed other measures that the European Union will want to take?
Okay. Because you'd wonder, though, whether sanctions are a good idea, because they would result in further isolation and further entrenchment of their position and a move perhaps closer to Russia.
Well, I think there has to be measures that respond firmly to an act of this kind, which put the crew and the passengers at risk. It put their safety at risk, this kind of behaviour. It's piracy in disguise, and it's just not acceptable. I mean, there are international rules there, and they have to apply. And, you know, consistently as a country, we've always been of the view that international rules-based organisations should exist. There has to be a basic system of international rules, and this flies in the face of all of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to this, the cyber attack, because today has been described as D-Day in relation to the attack on the HSE. The hackers threatened, as we know, to release a lot of information. Now, I'm sure you're aware that over the last week there have been WhatsApp messages flying around saying that the data is already out there, medical data, people hearing anecdotal examples. I've had messages myself on this. Is that happening? Is the data out there?
Well, there's no great evidence yet of any mass dumping of data. You know, as you know, the National Security, Cybersecurity Centre, the Gardaí, the HSE have teams now scouring you know, the various net to keep an eye on this and to monitor this very, very closely. If anybody has any suspicions, if anybody comes across any data, and if you see it, you know, don't share it, report it. That's the simple message we have. Mm-hmm. Report it to the Gardaí. So there's two strands to this. Fundamentally, we want to get services back as quickly as we possibly can. Progress has been made on that. The key is helping. The key that was given back is helping. So in terms of hospitals like the Mater, Tala, and James's in Beaumont, you know, they're getting services back on a gradual basis. Radiology is coming back, the NIMAS system.
Do you know why they gave back that key, the decryption key?
I don't. I mean, there's speculation as to why.
Because they wanted 20 million. I mean, that seems to be a given.
We're very clear we're not paying a ransom. Mm-hmm.
That was the demand, wasn't it, 20 million?
I don't have the specifics of that, but they did. Obviously, they didn't steal. It's a despicable act to steal someone's data. Now, they may not have realised that they had they're taking on an entire state or a government or a health service. But the data is perhaps where they see some value. But again, so far, we haven't seen any significant dumping of data.
And Claire also asked on Taoiseach about the exit from restrictions.
Let's move on to exiting lockdown now, because the mood music around this is good. We're told you'll have more announcements on Friday. But this big dark cloud on the horizon, the so-called Indian variant, genuine concern in Neffat about this. Will you adapt the reopening plan to take this into account, those concerns into account?
In relation to the Indian variant?
Yes.
We will. I think, first of all, the plan, the reopening plan so far is working. It's been cautious. It's been gradual. But, you know, our schools have come back. You know, construction has come back. Retail has come back. Various sporting activities are back, and all of that so far hasn't resulted in any spikes of significance, and so far so good in terms of the reopening of society. Now, we did say we would look at hospitality, and we've indicated for the second for hotels and that, and B&Bs and guest houses, and then the seventh for outdoor dining and outdoor drinking. What we'd like to do next week is to outline what is possible, what we feel is possible for June and July in respect of travel, for example, in respect furthermore of hospitality and indeed live entertainment and the arts. We may trial some events in June and then see what's possible in July. But we will take Neffat's advice, and that'll come Thursday. We are conscious of the variant. We don't want to, like, we've made such good progress now. There's no point in throwing that away.
Because given what we've heard about this variant and how it interacts with the vaccine, like, we only have 15% of our population fully vaccinated at this stage. So, I mean, caution must be the watchword here.
Absolutely, a caution has to be there's no question about that, and we will be cautious, but we are making rapid progress on the vaccination. You're correct, it's 15% fully vaccinated, 45%, over 45% now have received the first dose. The good news is that, yes, if you're at the two-dose vaccines, both RNA and AstraZeneca, do give protection against the Indian variant. But your point is a valid point, and we will be taking that into consideration.
Because looking at Pfizer and AstraZeneca, Public Health England saying that after the first dose of both, 33% effective against the Indian variant. So you can see how we could land ourselves in big trouble here if we're not careful.
Absolutely, yeah. We have to be careful as we proceed here.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, Aoife Madden called Joe after her experience queuing for the vaccine in Blanchardstown.
Well, I received a text message from the HSE that was organised by the Rotunda for me to go and get my vaccine.
Okay,
I'm currently 28 weeks pregnant.
Congratulations. Brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant.
So my time was for 10 to 3.
Mm-hmm.
I arrived 20 minutes early.
Okay.
Got out of the car and I could see the vaccination centre, and there was just women standing all over the car park.
Okay.
I walked up and I was saying, you know, where's the end of the queue? Where's the end of the queue? And everyone was kind of pointing. So I hopped into the queue and it was doubled up. So you had to go all the way around the car park and then all the way back around again before you even got to the vaccination centre. And everyone was very heavily pregnant.
Yeah.
There was no seats. There was no water. There was no one there helping, or no signs for a toilet. I counted and there was at least 56 women in front of me in the queue.
And obviously, your point is, obviously, by definition, everyone was pregnant. Two, among other things, when you're pregnant, it's not an illness by any stretch of the imagination. It's a fantastic time. But your bladder is under pressure.
Yeah.
Your bladder is under pressure. So, and there's nothing more embarrassing than trying to dance. So 56, how quickly did it move then?
I was there for about 20 minutes. I hadn't moved at all.
Okay.
And another 10 women had joined the queue behind me.
All right.
That my back was hurting me. My feet were starting to hurt like that. I needed to use the toilet.
Yeah.
I said, I can't do this. I can't stand here. Because my mother then, who was absolutely livid, went to the front of the queue and spoke to a lady who was much heavier pregnant than me.
Yeah.
and had been there on her feet for over an hour and a half.
Wow,
and she wasn't even in the building yet.
So what did you do? Or what were you forced to do?
I left. And I was very disappointed because I wanted to get my vaccine.
Of course, yeah.
But you wouldn't treat animals like that. And no water, nowhere to sit, nothing.
Yeah. And what was the weather like outdoors? It was horrific.
Okay, but the day before, Friday, it had been absolutely lashing.
Downpour, yeah.
So, if it had started raining, I don't know what the plan was.
Now, Aoife, could you know the way they do it? Remember when people used to queue up for houses and queue up for a place in a school? Could someone take your place? Or would that be unfair to the other woman?
There was a few men now that were standing in line for their wives or their girlfriends or whoever were in the car waiting.
Okay. Making a show of all the other men who weren't.
Yeah.
That's Aoife on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on today with Claire Byrne, the tyranny of the smartphone. Daniel Miller is Professor of Anthropology at University College London, and he was telling Claire why we're really all snails now. Lovely.
Well, I think the point was that you start off with this thing called a smartphone, and we're using it, you know, hundreds of times a day. It's so important in everyday life. And clearly, we need to understand what it is and how it affects us. Now, one problem is just that it's called a phone. And yet, if you think about it, phoning is one of the least things that we do with it. Mm-hmm. So we needed a different perspective. And we realized after a while that maybe it's actually better to think of it as a place within which we live, an analogy with the home. I mean, you can think of it as divided into rooms. You know, there's the place where you're watching football, the place where you're organizing your life, another place for shopping, another place for conversing with people. It may be the main address, you know, where people really want to know, are you there? Because they can get you. People tidy it and talk about tidying it as though it was like a home. Remember one of our informants actually in Africa saying, you know, I'm never going to allow that person in my home again. And he meant his phone. So we feel that's just a better starting point, really. But whether it's necessarily a negative thing is more complicated because, you know, you just gave that example of the fact that somebody should be with you in the restaurant and actually they're gone. They've gone, as it were, home. And so we tend to think, oh, that means the phone is a very anti-social thing. You know, it's screens instead of people, or it's phones instead of people. But actually, what are they doing on their smartphone? Chances are they're actually conversing with somebody else or texting with somebody else or, as you said, on their WhatsApp group. So it's not necessarily antisocial. It's really choosing a different group to be sociable with.
It's just rude.
And that makes the whole thing a bit more complicated.
It's just rude, Daniel, isn't it, if you're sitting with somebody else?
It is rude. And clearly one of the things is we're going to have to come up with new kind of rules of etiquette, I think. But that often happens with new innovations. You know, first they just disrupt and then after a short time we decide, well, that's fair enough, but that really is still rude.
Professor Daniel Miller from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.